You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Wonderful, majestic world around us. It's time for Dear Science. Thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
This week on Dear Science, we are joined once again by our expert, Dr. Kushla McGovern. Good afternoon.
Kia ora.
It's a lovely day here. Students running around on campus, busy, busy. And we've got lots of science to share with, well, with everyone, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what kind of science are we hearing about? We've got this this person discovered on the Silk Road doing what? What was she up to?
Well, we don't really know, but what was very distinctive about her is her teeth are red. So yeah, 2,200 years ago in the Xinjiang region of China, there was this woman who was obviously walking around with red teeth.
Mm.
And that's because they'd been stained with something called cinnabar, which is actually a highly poisonous mercury-based mineral.
A bit worrisome.
Yeah. And so this is the first time this has ever been discovered, that someone's pigmented their teeth with cinnabar.
Right.
Basically, yeah, they were in this region on the Silk Road and excavating a cemetery that was active between 202 and 8 BCE, so before now. And they found the remains of this woman who was probably 20 to 25 years old. And she stood out from all those around her because her teeth were red.
Mm.
And so they suspected that it was probably the cinnabar, because you do encounter cinnabar in a lot of contexts in ancient societies.
Right.
That it's red. And so they did do some analysis to, you know, confirm that it's red cinnabar. And so what they think probably happened is that this mineral was crushed up and put in with either egg white or egg yolk, so that it kind of acted like
a sticky sort of.
Yeah, exactly. And then they've painted it on her teeth.
Yeah, and why might they be painting it on her teeth?
We have no idea.
No clue.
No
right.
idea. So what they do know is that in China, cinnabar was used in decorations and burial rites and was seen as an elixir of mortality.
Hmm.
And what we also do know that is in some cultures, the teeth were actually revered as the seat of the soul.
Oh, okay.
Which is kind of interesting. So there's kind of one theory is maybe this was to ensure her immortality in the afterlife.
Right. That makes sense.
Yeah. And so, but it also could have been a mark, just a beauty thing. Like, people today wear makeup. Maybe she was staining her teeth red as a beauty thing.
Yeah, right.
Or it was higher social status sort of marker. We do know that in Chinese history, often red, and even today, it is associated with power and prestige.
Good colour.
Yeah. Mm. What's really interesting is there's no cinnabar in this region. So it had to come from quite some way.
Come from somewhere else.
So it's come from, like, they suggested Western Asia, southwestern China, even maybe Europe. So, so they're not – it's a really interesting observation, and they've got to try and understand from a societal point of view, like, why would you do this? They're also going to do some DNA testing of – her and the surrounding graves, just to see if you can see any familial connections and try and better understand what's maybe the societal structure here that could be leading to this.
Not sure what's going on, but there's some stuff going on with cinnabar.
Yeah, but the other thing is, like, I did say it was highly poisonous, right? So you kind of can imagine that, like, when they're using this, it's mercury sulfide and they're painting it on, you would get vapor that had mercury in it. So herself and probably her helpers would ingest, breathe this in, and that it actually has neurological effects. So if you've ever
ideal.
No, and if you've ever heard the term Mad Hatter?
Yes, yeah.
Right? This all comes from, in the 18th and 19th century, the people who made hats used to use a compound called mercury nitrate to treat the felt. And so they breathed in all this mercury.
Yeah, a lot of it, I'd imagine.
And so they had all these neurological effects, you know, like tremors and maybe hallucinations, mood swings. And so that's how you got Mad Hatters.
Wow, very interesting. And then what have we got here next about the colours of Mesozoic animals? Obviously, dinosaurs in popular culture, very brightly coloured, we're seeing. Maybe not so true?
Well, we don't really strictly know in some sense. So what we can say about dinosaur colour is there's these things called melanosomes. And so if you think of your body, you have organs, right?
Yep.
And in your cells, they have organelles. So it's even smaller structures within your body. And so when you have... within cells, you get these packets of melanin, which is the pigment that we're used to. Like, that's what gives us our various skin shades and stuff. So what happened in dinosaurs? Well, what happened in science maybe 10, 15 years ago, could be longer, is they observed that these melanosomes actually change shape with the type of melanin So you get one that's called eumelanin, and so this tends to be your black grays and browns, and so these would be rod-shaped melanosomes. And then if you got reds and yellow hues, these would be your spherical-shaped, and this is because you'd had pheomelanin. So the first time I heard this talked about, they talked about the sausages and the meatballs.
Right, and that makes sense.
And so you can look at, you could look at this patterning of these melanosomes, and you could start to make inferences about the colours. But this is very much when you've got those more, I would say, dull colours, you know, like the greys, the blacks, the browns, the rusty sort of colours.
Rusty reds, yeah.
It's not your, you know, a couple of weeks ago we were talking about birds of paradise that have these amazing,
very bright colours. Very bright. Yeah.
So that tends to be another pigment system and another sort of structural colour type. So what happened with dinosaurs and is that they discovered some fossils where they actually, the shape of these melanosomes had actually fossilized.
We've still got that evidence.
Yeah, so they had evidence that you could actually go, okay, these dinosaurs at least had some of this color, or that, you know, it was underlying. Maybe there was some other pigments on top that haven't been, they didn't fossilize, but we could start to make inferences. And what some of the leaders in this sort of research have done recently is actually they've taken to looking at mammals now. So they're starting to look at the fur in mammals. So what they did first off is you look at modern things, right, because we can see what colour it is.
Yeah, we can look at those.
Yeah, so we can look at those. We can use what's called a scanning electron microscope. So it's just a microscope that looks at really, really small things. And you can start to make, you can start to look at the patterns that you see in these melanosomes, and you can go look at, it's this colour. And, you know, it's the age of AI, so they've used these methods to develop a predictive model. So that what they have then done is they've got this model where they can go look at some fossils, and in this case they looked at mammals, just six different mammals where they had actually got some fossilization of these structures, and used this model to predict what they think that those Mesozoic mammals looked like,
right,
or what colours they were. And they kind of uninteresting colours.
Yeah, pretty dull, right?
They're dull, they're grey, like brownish grey.
If we're thinking of most mammals anyway, right? Dogs, I'm struggling to think of mammals off the top of my head, but horses, cows.
Exactly, right.
Right, we've got some pretty dull colours already.
Mammals are not the colourful animals of they're not the colourful ones of the animal kingdom,
no,
right? That's when we're thinking of the birds and the fishes and stuff. Yeah, so it's not maybe surprising that they kind of, we're a bit dull. And the other thing they pointed out is that the mammals that, the Mesozoic is the era of the dinosaurs, right? This is your Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous.
Yep.
So if you've got mammals running around, they tended to be small. They're probably going to be nocturnal because they're hiding from the big reptiles with the chompy teeth, right?
Yeah, prey animals.
So, exactly. So makes sense.
You want
not
to blend
really,
in a little bit.
Yeah. Bright and colourful.
Is there any chance we get similar progress, I guess, on the dinosaur types? What's the research there?
So there is a lot, there's been a lot of research and a lot of discoveries where you can start to make inferences about them being more like rusty red or black or, you know, grey. And then I suspect there's probably, I can't recall one off the top of my head, but there's probably some studies around patterning and stuff. And then you can also get it with bird fossils as well.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, because this is like, it all kind of came out of birds, right? Because birds are dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And so they were looking at birds and the melanosomes, and so those were the modern animals they were looking at, and then looking back into fossils. And so you get a lot of these fossils come out of China because you get really great preservation environments there.
Right.
Because you've obviously got to have a really well-preserved fossil to start seeing these structures.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then lastly here, life forming on planet Earth. I mean, this is a big one, right? This is about the original science, I guess.
Yeah. So this is, I saw the story, I remember as a first year at uni learning about this experiment and being amazed. And so when I saw this headline about the story, I was like, okay, got to talk about this more.
Yeah.
So Earth forms, and then for about, they think about a couple of billion years.
Pretty long time.
Get the orders of magnitude, right? We had an atmosphere that had a lot of chemicals swirling around in it, but none of them were really the molecules that we see in biology. Right. There weren't really a lot of molecules that had what we would say a carbon-nitrogen bond, which is really important. You find this in your proteins, your nucleic acids, a lot of what makes us up.
We need these for life. Yeah.
And so In 1953, there was an experiment conducted to test a hypothesis. So you had two scientists, Oprin and Haldane, had had this hypothesis, and then you had this PhD student, Miller, came along and conducted this experiment where he basically made a chamber, and it had methane, ammonia, hydrogen, water as gas in this chamber, and then he simulated lightning. So just used an electric charge to have lightning.
Yep.
And it was basically to see if this would form some of these molecules that we'd expect to see in biology.
Yeah.
And it did. He managed to produce several amino acids. So this was kind of, it's evidence for, okay, this is maybe how we started to get the molecules that then, lead on to, there's a lot more steps, obviously, to get life.
But I mean, you've got a lot of time, right?
Yeah.
Billions of years.
Exactly. And so what's really interesting, I only just read this about this experiment, because it's quite a famous experiment, and it was quite kind of controversial in that people were trying to repeat it and stuff. But when it was published, this was a PhD student, and his supervisor, this guy, Ure, actually went, I'm not going to put my name on this paper, not because I don't believe in this work, but because I think if my name is here, you won't get the credit that you deserve.
Oh, that's quite kind.
And then so he submits the paper to Science, which is a big, it's always been quite an important scientific journal. And Science didn't really look at it. And so then the supervisor wrote to them, because there's no email back in the day,
right,
and said, look at this paper, and
we've created life.
It got published. And what's also really cool about this is that in 2007, when this guy Miller died, he'd actually he'd kept some sealed vials of from his original experiment of the molecules that were produced. And so some other scientists just kind of took a look, and they could actually show that he'd produced more amino acids than he thought, because he was working back in the day with paper chromatography, and now we have a much better method.
Yep.
But anyway, so this was kind of the experiment. But a big critique of this idea in the way of this starting was, they're like, well, lightning's not really that frequent, right? And if we're talking about, the ocean, and because we've got to have the water around, it's quite large and it's dispersed. So really, is this the way? It could be part of it, but
the odds are pretty low. Yeah. Right, I understand.
And so that's what this study that's just come out is about, is they've gone, maybe you don't need a big lightning strike. Maybe what if you had lots of small micro lightning?
Ooh, what's micro lightning?
Yeah, and you're going, okay, what's micro lightning? And what it is that you can actually, with water droplets that you would get off breaking waves, you can actually get an exchange between them, an electrical, small electrical charge that produces this little micro lightning. And so then, this group study water droplets a lot. And so what they did was, they would make water droplets of different sizes, and they would see how they were charged. So larger droplets tended to be, let me get this right way around, larger droplets tended to be positively charged, the smaller droplets negatively charged. And so when they interacted, you got this little bit of micro lightning. So they're okay, we could get lots of water droplets coming off waves, lots of micro lighting.
And it seems like a thing that would happen.
Yeah. So, okay, we'll go the next step. We'll have a chamber that's got our nitrogen, our methane, all these gases in it. We'll put in some water droplets, and we'll see, just room temperature water, see what happens. And they actually managed to produce hydrogen cyanide, which maybe wouldn't be necessarily what we want for life, glycine, which is an amino acid, uracil, which you have in your RNA and stuff. And so they were like, okay, this actually...
We're getting the conditions for life.
Yeah. So it's... so that we don't need a big lightning strike.
No, we just need this little micro lightning.
Yeah.
Strange stuff that forms in water. Wow. And so when we're creating life like this, I mean, obviously we're not actually creating... We're creating these little bits.
Yeah, you're creating the building blocks.
The building blocks for life.
Right, yeah.
What's the process like afterwards? I mean, just obviously I know it's a long process, but briefly.
I didn't read up on this before this, which I should have, but I don't have a good grasp on it. There's a lot. There used to be actually a researcher. He's no longer in the Department of Physics, but he used to be there, and he used to call himself a theoretical biologist.
Ooh.
And it was because he basically was looking at, what sort of reactions do need to happen between these building blocks of life that so that you start to form things like DNA or, you know, proteins and stuff, and then how do they collect
that
you start
of
to
events.
Get,
yeah.
you know, and so it's, yeah, obviously long time scales and, yeah, things coming together the and right way.
Still mostly theory work that we're dealing with, or is it like a mapped out, like we don't know definitively
no,
how
I don't
life.
Think we know, like, as I say, like, this is getting very much beyond my knowledge, so I don't want anyone to quote me kind of thing, but it is, it's still, there's a lot of theory work still going on, so there's a lot of computation and stuff in that, and then, yeah, where you can, you do experiments to kind of show one part of the process and build up knowledge.
Very interesting. Maybe we'll hear more about it on a future Dear Science episode. I sure hope so. Otherwise, thank you for coming in this week, Kushla. Thank you, Mota, as always, and thank you, Science. We'll be right back after this short break. Keep it on the beat.
Well, I didn't know that before. Dear Science, thanks to MOTAT, the museum inspiring the innovators of tomorrow.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.